This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For more than a year and a half now, you've heard the rallying cries, listen to the scientists, follow the data. And you've been inundated with data. Pandemic infection rates, death rates, R-naughts, 14-day moving averages, just to name a very few. The public, awash in a new world of numbers and statistics, meant to aid good decision-making. But are those numbers and statistics leading to that good decision-making? What if good decisions can't be made? Because our basic relationship with, as one of our guests today calls it, COVID math, is broken.
So my name is Jenny Hunt, and I am a parent of a sixth grader in a Los Angeles public school on a Los Angeles Unified campus.
The Los Angeles Unified School District is the second largest school district in the country. 600,000 students in around 1,000 schools. Jenny works with a parent group called Speak Up.
We're a parent advocacy group trying to educate and activate parents to be more involved in policy decisions that affect our kids.
Well, back in March of 2020, you will remember that time, COVID-19 had just been declared a global pandemic, and schools around the country began to close.
I actually pulled my kid out of school before they shut down because a lot of parents, including me, did not know what was going on. And I was very, very concerned about the health of my child. And I said, there's no way these kids can distance in his small classroom. We can't keep 6 feet between them. I pulled my kid out and signed a petition along with thousands of parents calling for them to shut down the schools and, you know, to close it down until we knew what was going on.
Well, Los Angeles public schools closed for more than a calendar year. And during that time, Jenny saw her son's life change.
For more than a year, he was fully online at home. He was an only child. I was working full time. My husband was working full time. We were fortunate enough to be able to work from home, but we really did not have any time at all to help him with his schooling. And like millions of kids, he definitely struggled academically and fell behind.
And that's when Jenny knew something bigger had to change.
I went from being one of the first parents to pull my kid out to being one of the most vocal advocates for them to start following the science and opening it back up once things became safe to reopen. And of course, that did not happen. In Los Angeles Unified, we were probably among the last places on the entire planet to reopen.
It was a contentious spring of 2021 in Los Angeles, with parent groups protesting for schools to open and the LA's teachers union expressing caution and concern about plans they said could put teachers at risk. Ultimately, the most influential factor in reopening LA schools? Governor Gavin Newsom submitted a state budget that linked school funding to in-person attendance. More importantly for Jenny, though, she says that for her, the biggest change was in the data she saw over the summer. Data on how masks and ventilation could help curb the spread of COVID. And she says when school started in August of this year, LAUSD had some of the strongest safety protocols in the country, which she supports.
There's masking 100% of the time, indoor and outdoor. And then they have weekly COVID testing for every student and staff member. They have upgraded every ventilation system with MERV 13 filters. So they have some of the best ventilation systems in the country.
Those weekly COVID tests, by the way, cost the Los Angeles School District around $350 million total. School, though, opened on August 16th. And by the second week, the district reported about 3,000 active positive cases among students. But only 7 of those were linked to a school setting. All positive cases were sent home to quarantine. And here's the thing. So were their close contacts, who, if unvaccinated, had to stay at home for at least 8 days. The Los Angeles Unified School District says their policies were based on guidance from the LA County Department of Health. Well, the LA Health Department collected more data. From the first day of school in mid-August to the middle of September. And the LA Health Department found that because of that rule about close contacts, LA schools sent home almost 30,000 people to quarantine. And of those 30,000, only 63 of them had contracted COVID-19. So based on those numbers, the county health department made a recommendation to LA Unified Schools, a modified quarantine protocol that would keep more kids in class longer. Now, here's the thing, though. This was a suggestion, not a requirement. Districts did not have to implement this new modified policy if they did not want to. And the Los Angeles Unified School District chose not to.
Los Angeles Unified completely ignored that health department data and advice, and they kept quarantining kids. I and many, many of our parents were advocating for them to change the rules and to follow the data and the science coming out of the health department. It's very frustrating when you have this data and they change the rules because kids are not contracting COVID in school because you have all these wonderful safety precautions, but they're still sending these kids home unnecessarily. That was very frustrating. School board members and school superintendents are not health department experts. They're not scientists. So let's listen to the scientists. Let's make decisions based on data. That's what we have been asking for. And it's been very frustrating as a parent to see that not happening in Los Angeles. And it's our kids who have suffered.
That's Jenny Hauntz, parent of a sixth grader in the Los Angeles Unified School District. Jenny works with a parent group called Speak Up. Well, we are trying to understand how much the data says and how to follow it and how to use it to make the best decisions in the COVID-19 pandemic and whether our basic relationship with that data is actually broken. So let's turn now to someone making those decisions. Nick Melvoin joins us from Los Angeles. He's vice president of the LA Unified School District Board of Education. Nick Melvoin, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you heard parent Jenny Hauntz there just say that members of the board are not scientists or health department experts, so follow the data. Can you walk me a little bit through LA Unified's decision-making on the modified quarantine protocol?
I can. And Jenny's absolutely right. And I should thank Jenny not only for her advocacy, but Jenny is actually the one who let me know about this new modified quarantine policy, which Meghna, I think is one of the problems throughout this pandemic. It's not only the lack of clear and consistent direction from the county, state, and federal health departments, because the school district is many things, but we're not a public health entity, but even the communication. And so I got a text from Jenny Hauntz that said, here's a new LA Times article about this permissive quarantine policy. We were not given any sort of heads up from the county health department. And then we had to navigate yet another data point as we were making decisions. And so,
can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah.
Oftentimes conversations go in directions you don't expect. So the LA County Health Department undertook this examination of school-based quarantine procedures and then made a recommendation and didn't tell LAUSD or didn't tell any school district in LA County. I'm a little confused.
Exactly. I was too at the time. So LA Unified, there are 88 school districts in LA County. LA Unified is the largest. We are the second largest in the nation. We educate 10% of kids in the state of California. And we are not a public health entity. And so as we talked about spring of 2020, we made the decision to close schools before anyone told us to, because the county was, in my mind, dragging their feet. When we had to reopen, we looked at data. We weren't allowed to reopen until the county and the state told us that we, as a county, had cleared some hurdles. And then a few weeks into the school year, again, through the LA Times, we learn as a school district, our superintendent and our board, we learned through the LA Times that there is now this other option, not even a recommendation, just an option with a whole list of caveats. And this is one of the things that I didn't understand when I was first reading that article and was advocating, as was Jenny, for the school district to adopt this new policy, that the fine print was important here. And that was that, well, you can adopt this other quarantine policy if you test kids not once a week, which is what we're doing, kind of the most comprehensive testing protocol in the nation for a school district. But if you test those kids who are close contacts every few days, if you have the teacher sign an affidavit that the student never took off their mask, even outdoors, which is really tough for teachers who have, you know, dozens of kids to say, oh yeah, during that few day period, you know, little Johnny over there never took off his mask once. A requirement that during those period of close contacts that we enforce 6 feet social distancing, which we haven't had to do in our schools for months, but only for those students who were close contacts. And this was key for a population of students where 82% of kids are living in poverty and parents don't have the luxury necessarily to come and go as they please. This modified quarantine policy was only for in-person learning. It wasn't for before school activities, after school sports, extracurriculars. So you basically drop your kid off. They're there for in-person learning, and then they can't even really participate in activities during lunch, and you have to pick them up right when the bell rings. So it was more complicated than meets the eye. The benefits were, of course, clear, as Jenny alluded to, which is keeping kids in school. But the drawbacks and the challenges were there as well. And this has just been kind of endemic to this pandemic, which is that you peel back the envelope and there's more data and other data points that the district had to consider.
Okay, so first of all, while I can, I want to get my plug in for local journalism. God bless the Los Angeles Times for doing its job, letting the community know what's going on within the county of Los Angeles County here. But we've just got about 30 seconds to go before a break, and Nick Melvoin, just list if you could briefly. What are the groups of stakeholders you have to consider when making policy decisions across LA Unified?
Yeah, so we have, of course, our students. We have their parents. And like I mentioned, over 80% of the kids in LA are living in poverty. We have a handful of labor unions, our teachers, our bus drivers, our custodial workers. We have principals. We have the county health department. We have the county board of supervisors. We have the city and the mayor of Los Angeles. And we have seven board members who come to each problem with their own unique vantage point. So okay. It's not an easy decision.
It is quite a mix there here. And we're talking about how data, good COVID data, should ease the decision making, even amongst such a diverse group of stakeholders. So we'll have a lot more about that when we come back. And I should know that we did reach out to the LA County Health Department. They were unable to join us today, but more in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And follow the data, right? That's supposed to be the way out of the mess of this pandemic. But today we are talking about whether our relationship to that very data is broken. And I'm joined today by Nick Melvoin. He's vice president of the Los Angeles Unified School District Board of Education. And LA, in a sense, is serving as our test case on the things that can happen with broken COVID math. And let's listen to a moment to Eric Happel. He's a data analyst in Portland, Oregon. And here's what he says.
If we had used the data and used math correctly and been honest with people, we could have actually gotten ourselves out of this mess a long time ago. So math could have been a solution for us, but instead it got in the way.
Now, Eric is co-author of an article titled How to Fix Our Broken Relationship with COVID Math. And his co-author, Dr. Tracy Hoag, joins us now. And we've got a link to the article at onpointradio.org. Dr. Hoag, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Good to be here.
Okay, so we're going to spend some time discussing in detail the lessons to be learned in the challenges faced by the Los Angeles Unified School District here. So tell me a little bit about what you heard in that journey that we took with parent Jenny and Nick Melvoin on the board. What role did data and math play here?
Yeah, I think that I had a similar experience both as a parent, as a researcher, as someone who's a double citizen, American Danish double citizen. I was able to look from the perspective of two countries. And in terms of Jenny's experience at LA Unified, you know, I was also one of the first people to pull my kids out of school that, you know, like I wanted to. I felt like that was the appropriate thing in March of 2020. And then as the data came in and we realized the risk to kids and that schools could be open safely from what we were seeing in Europe, I grew very concerned with the prolonged school closures, especially seeing Denmark open schools in April of 2020 and was basically able to keep them open. So there was a divide, I thought, between the science and what we were doing with public schools in the United States, especially.
Okay, so it's a familiar story then to you. What is the basic thesis here in your in this article that you co-wrote, which is about fixing our broken relationship with COVID math? What do you mean?
Yeah, so basically our impression, and my co-authors, Leslie Bienen and Eric Hoppel, was that we in the United States, the public has a warped sense of risk and that in terms of the risks that COVID posed to people of different ages. So there's a very steep age gradient for COVID and risk. So per infection, if you look at it, so children have a 1 in 500 to 1 in 1,000 risk of hospitalization, where someone over 80 has a 29% risk of hospitalization if infected. So this, you know, it's an multi-thousand-fold risk of difference in terms of mortality. And this has not been really expressed to the public. And same with the incredible effectiveness of vaccines in terms of preventing severe disease. So we were concerned that American people, the public, were not getting, you know, accurate information in terms of how to assess risk. And so and we're rather basing risk on anecdotes and stories that tried to create fear rather than actual data. So we wanted to create some rules for both public health agencies and for media outlets in terms of reporting the data more accurately and sort of like conveying when there is a higher amount of risk and when there's a lower amount of risk.
You mean we shouldn't be saying things like cases have doubled when it might be going from 1 to 2?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a perfect example because, you know, just because if cases go up 20%, like we talked about in the article, in kids, it's like if they now are 20% of the total 20% of the total cases, as has been reported, that doesn't mean the raw number actually went up. And you need to have raw numbers to put things into context and local numbers as well to really understand, you know, how many kids are really getting infected? How severe is it?
Right. So context is the key here. And we'll come back to that in a second. But in your article, you write that nearly 2 years into this pandemic, quote, "We are still estimating risk as though it were March 2020." But who's the we in this case, Dr. Hoag?
Yeah, so I really think this has become a vicious cycle. It's a combined issue with media outlets realizing that, you know, they can get more clicks, more reads if they, you know, create more fearful scenarios. And then, you know, public health agencies and the CDC and local public health agencies as well, not providing really readily accessible, clearly understandable data that everyone can read. So it's like people are going to news sources that are trying to sell a story or fear or get reads rather than actually give accurate information. And it's perpetuating, you know, now we have very effective vaccines. We have the unvaccinated age group is by far the lowest risk, very low risk, similar to influenza in terms of risk. And the restrictions on kids are in some places becoming more strict. And so it does not make sense in terms of, you know, what we see when you actually look at the data.
Okay, so let's return to our case study of the second largest school district in the country, Los Angeles Unified here. So Nick Melvoin, vice president of the board there for LAUSD. You've been listening to Dr. Hoag here. And in her article, she writes that an underlying cause of confusion is the fact that local data, essential for decision-making around COVID-19 risks, are not easily accessible or understandable in the public in this case, including the media. So can you give us a sense, Nick, about how the data that you felt you needed was it accessible? Did you get what you need? How did that come into play in the decision making that the LA board has had to do over the past, you know, year and a half?
It was rather challenging. And that goes back to my earlier point about the district not being a public health agency. And so we were looking at the county numbers, the city numbers, the state numbers. And I will say those weren't always the same numbers. And when you looked at, you know, positive cases out of 100,000 or the rolling 14-day average, they didn't exactly match. And that it was at its most inane, I think, when we had a series of overlapping color-coded systems from the state and the county of when we could open. So we were in the red tier or the purple tier. And in California, the purple tier was even worse than the red tier. And people were confused about that. And it didn't, to your guest's earlier point, necessarily differentiate between children's data and adult data and what we were seeing in schools versus in the community. We also, COVID rates were one data point, and there were others that I was advocatively looked at. What is the data of academic loss? What is the data of acute kind of mental health challenges we're seeing in students? And how do we put this in context? Because we talked a lot in the spring of 2021 about the risk of reopening schools. We did not talk enough about the risk of keeping schools closed. And what were those data points? And that's what we're starting to see now. There was a great, just to plug the LA Times again, there was another article last week about the huge achievement gaps that we're seeing in LA schools. Well, these were things that I flagged last year, but the data around academics was took a back seat to the data around COVID rates, not inappropriately so, but that was another data point that was muted that now we're seeing a lot about, were the data about women in the workforce, about parents who couldn't go back to work until schools were open. So the frustration for me wasn't that the data was conflicting or hard to follow. It was that we were only looking at COVID data. Uh-huh. We weren't looking at the other things that are important to families.
Okay, so this is an important point. Dr. Hoag, let me turn back to you on there, because there's, you know, it's not just one data set we're talking about. It's data that ideally provide insights into all sorts of aspects of life that it has been severely impacted by a pandemic, aka everything, right? I mean, and Nick Milvoyne talking about educational attainment, impact on the workforce, et cetera. But one of the things that policymakers have to deal with is deciding, in a sense, like, not in a black and white way, but in an emergency situation, there are some data sets, aka COVID-related specifically around illness, that are going to be more important, right? So how would you suggest, Dr. Hoag, that they handle that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I just want to echo what Nick said, that, you know, we really need to also, we need to be both looking at risk in terms of, with when we're talking about children, looking at risk in terms of context and in terms of the trade-offs of what we're doing. And so, you know, when you look at the COVID risk to kids and you say, okay, so their risk of dying of suicide is, or sorry, of drowning is 2.5 to 12 times higher than of COVID, and a risk of dying of a motor vehicle accident is 10 times higher. Like, we need to be sort of like comparing these risks to other things in kids when we're looking at COVID. And then I want to echo about the trade-offs that we've been seeing, the increasing rates in obesity and diabetes and mental health disorders. And so, you know, we should have been looking at those data sets along with the COVID to see, you know, how are these things changing in kids, and which kids, you know. We ended up moving our kids to a private school district so they could continue in school. But, you know, kids in the public school district, often of lower socioeconomic status, they were the ones who paid the biggest price for the school closures. And, you know, we should have been looking at data like that too, not just a myopic focus on only the COVID risks.
Right. I mean, the school situation is so uniquely local in this country, right? Because in some districts, there has been consistent and passionate pushback from, say, teachers' unions about reduce or changing protocols around COVID. In other districts, there's been incredible pushback from parents who don't even want their kids to wear masks in school. So what's going, is there something similar, Dr. Hoag, going on in each of those cases where the initial response to any potential policy change that claims to be based on data is met with resistance, fear, anger?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of the decisions based around schools have been based on political beliefs and regional beliefs rather than the national science. And I would say that I was senior author of the Wood County, Wisconsin study published by the CDC in the MMWR journal. And, you know, we showed before vaccinations that schools could open safely with minimal spread in the schools. We saw that nationally, like, it was very individual in terms of if it was a red or blue state, whether or not they chose to open the schools. And it didn't seem like it was being based on data from science, but rather, you know, perceived risks of that local place or the political beliefs of that particular place.
But the point being that regardless of sort of where one falls on the political spectrum, data wasn't necessarily the driving influence in the response to a lot of policy changes. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So you know what I'd love to do? I'd love to hear you kind of give us an analysis of where someone like Nick Melvoin finds themselves. Again, Nick being vice president of the Los Angeles Unified School Board here, because he was describing minute ago that basically even after the LA Health Department, County Health Department, came up with this modified quarantine idea for schools, it really sounded like a Scylla and Charybdis situation to me, because on the one hand, they could continue, which they opted to do, their sort of quarantine everyone who's also a close contact protocol, which, as we talked about earlier, led to some 30,000 students in LA schools being quarantined, and only 63 of them had COVID. Or the new protocol, as Nick described, included things like testing multiple times per week, asking teachers to sign affidavits that they'd be wearing their masks outdoors also, trying to enforce 6-foot distancing, which is no longer really needed and physically impossible in a place like in the school rooms of Los Angeles County. So was that modified protocol any better, Dr. Ho?
I mean, I would say no. I would say that, you know, we have data from The Lancet from the UK looking at this test to stay, it's called, type of avoidance of quarantine, basically, that if you test a child every day after they've been exposed at least 5 days out of the week, and they test negative, they can stay in school. And they ended up with that ended up being equivalent to quarantining kids. And just keep in mind that these kids, you know, under the age of 12, they were not masking. And we do not have data supporting masking kids outdoors. So that's another thing we need to be looking at. Like, why are we doing this? What data supports doing this?
Can I just jump in here for a second? I mean, the thing that perplexes me is this alternative protocol is coming from the LA County Department of Health, which ostensibly are the scientists that we're supposed to be listening to.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we need to be more willing to look at also international data in this case. And I'm not sure exactly where they're getting their guidance from, if they're being influenced by teachers' unions on these decisions. I think that we need just more collaboration also with the CDC on a national level, like in terms of, you know, what each school district should be doing. I would love it if the CDC would come out and say we can now start this test to stay protocol to keep kids in school to avoid quarantine. So there's like a national effort to keep kids in school as much as possible, according to the science, because right now we have, I believe it's over 30 states. They've already initiated the test to stay program before the CDC even came in and said, yes, let's do it. So we need a little bit more guidance from the CDC and, you know, that minimizes harm to kids.
OK, so we're going to talk more about, again, this broken relationship with COVID math. But Nick Melvoin, I've got to let you go in a minute here. I have one last question for you. As vice president of the school board there in Los Angeles, you described all the stakeholders that are part of the LA schools, students, parents, principals, administrators, various unions, teachers' unions, janitorial unions, et cetera, bus drivers. You have the city, the mayor, the county, probably even the governor, too. Can you be honest with me and tell me, given all those stakeholders and their various interests, sometimes they overlap, sometimes they don't, When you have to make decisions, when the board has to make decisions, really, how much does data play a role? How influential can data be? Or do other factors supersede the importance of data?
Unfortunately, Meghna, other factors do supersede the data. The framework that we had to reopen schools last spring, when many of us, myself included, thought we needed to get kids back in person, was once you hit a certain permissive tier, you could only reopen if you had the agreement with your labor unions. So the data could have been zero positive cases per a million kids. And if we didn't have sign off from the labor unions, we couldn't reopen.
Well, Nick Melvoin is vice president of the Los Angeles Unified School District Board of Education. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Hoag, stand by for just a moment because we have a lot more to talk about, not just about how broken our, meaning the public's relationship with COVID math is, but how to fix it. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and a glimpse into your future. Tomorrow on Point, we're going to be talking about inflation. And specifically, this basic question, what is it? How does it happen? Why does it even exist? Why does milk and meat and vegetables and gas cost more today than it did 50 or 100 years ago, or even than it did a year ago? So we want to hear from you. Are you seeing inflation in your life? What's the impact of it in your life? And also, what are your questions about this amorphous but essential concept in the American economy, about inflation? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. It's the everything you wanted to know about inflation hour, but were afraid to ask. That's on Point tomorrow. Today, we are talking about our broken relationship with COVID math and how to fix it. It's from an article co-written by Dr. Tracy Hoag, who joins us from Sacramento, California, and all the different ways in which the data around COVID are presented to you, the public, to policymakers, and how we, the media, are part of that problem here. So, for example, here's Allison Schrager, who studies risk at the Manhattan Institute, and she thinks we just have to come up with a much better way to communicate those risks.
We very precisely can measure risk now. We usually do it in this form of probabilities. But that's a relatively recent invention, and so it's not surprising that our minds can't quite get around what's a probability and how meaningful is that. So I think rather than like blaming people for just being bad at it, I think we could also to say, well, how can we communicate probabilities in ways that are more natural to people?
That's Allison Schrager at the Manhattan Institute. Dr. Hoag, stand by for just a moment because I want to welcome into the conversation Jonathan Rothwell, who's principal economist at Gallup. Jonathan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
I'd love for you to actually tell us, give us a couple of more examples of how people across the board have sort of been misunderstanding numbers and statistics around COVID. For example, Gallup found that Democrats who were polled were saying that an inflated number of people who got COVID were going to the hospital. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. In partnership with the investment firm Franklin Templeton, we launched a number of surveys last year, and one in December asked U.S. adults to basically give us what percentage of people have been infected by the coronavirus and needed to be hospitalized. The correct answer at the time was between 1% and 5%. There was a little bit of uncertainty within that range. But only 18% of all U.S. adults gave the correct answer, and Democrats did much worse than Republicans. Only 9%, actually 10% of Democrats gave the correct answer, compared to 26% of Republicans. And 41% of Democrats said that more than half of people who had been infected by the coronavirus needed to be hospitalized. So,
which is wildly wrong. Were they
wildly off. Yeah, hospitals would be completely overflooded with patients if that were the case.
It's more like, just to be clear, like what between 1 and 5%. Okay, so they were off by a factor of 10. So that's a lot. Right. And so the implications of that then, Jonathan?
Well, we asked them about their behaviors and their attitudes, and we've been collecting these data throughout the pandemic. And people who were more wrong about estimating risks, exaggerated the risks, were much more likely to isolate themselves from other people. So they're social distancing more aggressively. They're less likely to be going out shopping, to be going to restaurants in person. They're less likely to be traveling. Some people might say, well, that's a good thing, but it has real economic consequences. And the social distancing has some serious mental health consequences, which we also uncovered in our surveys, and that people who were social distancing at a much greater extent, especially if they're social distancing because they don't understand the risks, were more likely to report anxiety, depression, feelings of loneliness. So there's some real costs to this misinformation.
But it works both ways, though, right? Because we see the cost of misinformation for people who are choosing to live their lives as if they are risk-free from COVID as well.
Indeed. And the clearest, I'd say, example of that in recent work that we've done found that Republicans were much less likely to basically attributes safety from the vaccine. And we asked again, what percentage of people overall are hospitalized who are vaccinated and unvaccinated? And then the ratio of those two can be used to calculate the assumed efficacy of the vaccine, how good it is at preventing hospitalizations. And Republicans were much less likely to give an accurate representation of vaccine efficacy, and unvaccinated Republicans basically suggested that the vaccine had no benefits in terms of protecting against hospitalization risk. And we know that there's a huge partisan gap in vaccination and willingness to be vaccinated. And so presumably a big part of that gap is the false belief that the vaccine offers very little or no protection against hospitalization.
Okay. So, you know, as you both you and Dr. Hoag know very well, we are all of us basically we're like walking risk calculators, just living our lives every day, right? I often say that the most dangerous thing I do every single day is crossing the street in the city of Boston. Yes, I'm going to take a second to knock on my fellow Bostonians and their terrible driving habits. But my point is that the question is how accurately do we measure those risks on a day-to-day basis for us as individuals? And of course, that means that there's going to be, you know, 330 million different right answers. I just wonder, like, how are we supposed to balance those trade-offs then when we have to scale up from the individual level to the societal level, Jonathan Rothwell?
Well, one thing that gives me hope is that we conducted an experiment that gave people high quality, clear information. That it was basically a sentence or two that could come from a newspaper headline. We said things like the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that students be in person, and described a little bit of their recommendation. And in other instances, we gave people information about the number of hospitalizations and the trends and the cases, as you would see in many media publications. And in others, we gave more positive information. And we found that it had large effects on people's attitudes and behaviors, their willingness to support open schools, for example, in-person learning, their willingness to plan for travel. And we also found that if you give Republicans and Democrats pieces of information that go against their prior biases, you can really eliminate the partisan gap in beliefs and attitudes.
Interesting. Dr. Ho, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I just want to thank Jonathan for that research. It's that was very informative. And yeah, I just want to echo, you know, what he said in terms of people, you know, our biggest problems have been basically overestimating the risk to children and healthy children, and underestimating the risk to older adults with risk factors. And I guess I would add a piece to that is, like, internationally, when you look at the news, they're much less likely to be negative in terms of COVID as the United States' news has been. And I think that would just add to basically what Jonathan is saying, that, you know, they have, especially in Scandinavia and actually a lot of Europe, they've been much quicker to open up with higher adult vaccination rates, despite, you know, not all kids being vaccinated yet, because their perception is, you know, now we're much lower risk. Adults, you know, are vaccinated. Kids are not necessarily vaccinated yet. But, you know, we know from the data, actually, from the UK, from our own country, that unvaccinated kids are at similar risk for hospitalization and severe disease as 40 to 60 year old adults who are double vaccinated. And just that simple fact, you know, that would reassure a lot of people, but that's not the information we're getting. We're getting, like, anecdotes, like, this is one child who's in the hospital who has severe disease, you know, rather than looking at the big picture of risk. And not that that child is not important, but that obviously happens with many different diseases. And we need to look at risks and context, and what are the trade-offs of, you know, keeping kids from having their normal lives. And this is the societal question you're getting to. How can we minimize harm?
So this is really, really important. And I just want to pick up on something you just said, Dr. Hoag, about how internationally in other countries, the media coverage of COVID maybe isn't so unrelentingly negative, or at least sort of, let me put it this way, positive data are also presented. Because, you know, now we're more than a year and a half into this, and I can definitely hear the argument that we should be talking about the fact that, you know, 95-98% of people who contract COVID never end up in the hospital. And in fact, if you are vaccinated, basically almost 0% of people who are vaccinated and may have one of those very rare breakthrough cases end up in the hospital. We should be saying that more in the media now. But in the United States a year and a half ago, couldn't you make the argument that basically doing the relentless focus on the dangers of COVID was in fact necessary to get people to pay attention to the seriousness of what was about to befall the world?
I mean, I in the beginning, I agree with you that we did not fully understand, you know, what the hospitalization rate and the mortality rate was from COVID, and we didn't fully understand how it was spread. And so, you know, it really made sense to get the word out, like, you know, we're shutting society down until we get more information, until we know exactly how this is spread, exactly what the risks are to different age groups. But then, you know, in the United States compared to in Europe, our process for reopening things and for conveying this is the lower risk group, this is the higher risk group, this is, you know, outdoors is much lower risk than indoors, like, kids are lower risk than adults, like, that sort of information was very, very slow to come out in the United States compared to internationally.
Mm. Jonathan Rothwell, let me turn back to you on something, because, again, I'm just trying to work my way through what are the alternate possibilities for how we communicate risk and how we use these data in order to make decisions around risk. And I'm thinking that there are some examples in which, no matter what the data say, the safe thing to do is to presume a higher risk than there is. And the one example that comes to mind is that in the case of, say, pregnant women and alcohol, right? I mean, Emily Oster has been in the lead on amassing the data and finding that perhaps that the risk of the risk to women and their children with some mild alcohol consumption during pregnancy is not as high as you're told when you go to see your obstetrician or your primary caregiver, and they say don't drink. But I've also spoke to members of the American College of Obstetrics who say, we will continue to advise women to not drink at all during pregnancy, because for those small number of women for whom something bad could happen, the cost is too high. right? The outcome is too devastating. So a blanket no is the better way to go as an overall policy. I'm just wondering how, you know, how you think through that in terms of how we talk about this global pandemic as well.
Yeah, I think that I can understand the motivation for that attitude, but I think it's very destructive to trust, and it's very destructive to cooperative action that is required across political groups, across diverse communities, to take on something as daunting as a pandemic. And so as a result, the people who have on purpose withheld the full picture in order to act as almost like parents for the country have lost a great deal of credibility. And it's very hard to see how that credibility is going to come back in the next few years or decades, really, especially among Republicans who have lost just incredible amount of trust in the CDC as a result of the mask policy, where first we were told that only doctors should wear masks and nurses. And then we were told that everyone actually benefits from a mask, whether or not you have a degree. And so that was, I think, very much the same kind of motivation where you didn't. So I think the truth is really what we need, and we need to respect people's intelligence to be able to understand it when it's presented in a clear way. And a clear way is not putting up a CSV file with thousands of data points. A clear way is giving people a takeaway from an expert analysis.
Right.
Like Dr. Hoeg is doing right now.
As a personal fan of CSV files, I still take your point here. But so Dr. Hoeg, in the last few minutes that we have, there, you actually have practical recommendations here, and I want to go over some of them very, very quickly because we only have 2 minutes here. One, report raw numbers instead of percentages. We already talked about why that's important, right? Because of the distorting effect that percentages might have. Two, you say place risk assessment in the context of other risks. Can you briefly explain what that means?
Yeah, so we kind of touched on that already, but when we use the example of the risk in children and comparing that to in terms of mortality, you know, in the same range, similar risk to influenza on an annual basis, that like motor vehicle accidents are 10 times more likely to result in mortality among kids than COVID. And then you need to place the risk in context of the trade-offs. So we've kind of been discussing that as well, like what happens to kids when you take away their normal life, you know, increasing obesity, diabetes, mental health crises was just announced by the AAP. I think people understand risk better in context when it's compared to something that they're used to, another risk that they're used to.
There's another thing you recommend about one size fits none. Do not frame risk in terms of a generic person. And I think the media is 100%, including us here, guilty of that because anecdotes, in a sense, are what drive a lot of reporting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Jonathan's research also pointed to this, that people tend to really overestimate the risk to the lowest risk people and underestimate it, you know, to older adults with obesity or cancer, when we should be really focusing on that they have an extremely high risk, need to get vaccinated, whereas kids, you know, they can basically should be able to lead their normal lives, with very few caveats. So.
Well, Dr. Tracy Hoeg, physician and co-author of How to Fix Our Broken Relationship with COVID Math. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org, where you can see some of her other recommendations as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Rothwell, principal economist at Gallup, thank you for joining us as well. This is On Point.